Now, some of you may be familiar with Eeyore, and the game that theologians like to play is pin the tail on Eeyore, and the question is, where does the rapture go? And so, we hold to the pre-trib rapture, but there are those that argue for the mid-trib, the three-quarters trib, also known as the pre-wrath view, and the post-trib view. On your notes, you'll notice that I also mentioned a no-rapture view. Those that do not realize that the rapture and second coming are two separate events end up merging the two. And so we're going to argue for the pre-trib rapture. And the question now is, does Revelation reveal the rapture? Now, we're here looking at a floor of a car, the driver's area. I have a friend down in Texas that his mother was a school bus driver, and as she was getting to the place where she was supposed to drive into a driveway and make a Y turn in order to turn around on her route, the owner left the car in the driveway. So she told her son, please go start the car, move it so that I can turn around. And he looked at it, where's the clutch? He was a farm boy, he had never seen an automatic transmission. He was worried that he was going to grind the gears in. So he went back, told his mother, there's no clutch, what do I do? Well, the problem in the book of Revelation that results from the interpretation that we have given on chapter 3, verse 10, is, where is the rapture in the book of Revelation? Wouldn't we expect in a book that looks at seven churches that are in the first century within the church age, and then goes into a discussion of the tribulation, then a short discussion of the millennium, and a short discussion of the eternal state, where is the rapture? We would expect to find the rapture in that book, would we not? Yes. Just like my friend Dale was saying, where's the clutch? The question here becomes, where is the rapture in the book of Revelation? Once again, here we have the differing views on the rapture. The pre-trib rapture, you'll notice that the vertical arrow for the rapture does not touch the wrath line. There's a very simple reason. The rapture does not start the tribulation. The issue is that the rapture must precede the start of the tribulation, but it is not simultaneous with the beginning of the rapture. Beginning of the tribulation. Sorry, my tongue is running ahead of me. Each view, in light of 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 9, as we've talked about earlier in this series, every one of them puts the rapture before where they say that wrath begins. The reason for that is Paul tells us in 1 Thessalonians 5:9 that the church is not destined for wrath. So what happens? All these various views come up with various excuses for saying that that wrath does not characterize the entire seven-year period. But if wrath does characterize the entire seven-year period, there is only one view that succeeds in keeping the church out of wrath, and that is the pre-tribulation rapture view. We will later on be talking about why it is that we see the entire seven-year period being characterized by wrath. That will come up a little later. Let's look at a general picture of human history. This is a simplified dispensational chart. It looks at how God has administered and will administer human history. In Genesis 1 through 11, he dealt with all of humanity. But then in Genesis chapter 12, he chose Abraham. And Israel was supposed to be a light for the Gentiles. So God chose to deal with planet Earth through Israel. Now, since 33, the year 33 AD, at the day of Pentecost, God inserted into history something that the Old Testament never predicted. Paul in Ephesians chapter 3 calls it a complete mystery that was unknown. God had not revealed it. He knew about it, but he did not reveal that he was, instead of working through Israel to reach the world, he was going to do so through a new entity, the church. Now, you'll notice quite often I capitalize church. I'm not talking about any denomination. Church means not a building. Church is a reference to people. But it is people during a specific time period between the day of Pentecost, when the church began, Acts chapter 2, up until the rapture. That period of time on earth is known as the church age. You may remember, though, that Israel has a second part. We talked about that in the very first session when we looked at Daniel chapter 9. There, remember that we had a prophecy of 77s, or 490 years. 483 of those years are past. But the passage set up a gap and said that there were certain events that would not happen during the 69th week, nor would they happen during the 70th week, but they would occur after the end of the 69th. Specifically, the Messiah had to be cut off. He was killed. That was after the end of the 69th heptad, the 483 years. And also, Jerusalem had to be invaded. That happened after the end of the 483rd year. All of this shows that there had to be a gap in time, because God was counting time on Israel time. Now, what do I mean by Israel time? Imagine that we have someone that went to university for 2 years, then dropped out, got a job, got married, had kids, and after 10 years went back to university. Would we say this is his 13th year of university? No, it is his third year. And even though there was a gap of 10 years, if we're talking university time, it was years 1, 2, 3, 4. Israel time works the same way. God predicted a 483-year period of time, but it was under Israel time. It's counted here, and it's counted during that 7-year period known as the tribulation. Then after that, we have the second coming, and Jesus establishes the millennial kingdom for 1,000 years on planet Earth. We still haven't talked about how is it that Israel, that the book of Revelation reveals the rapture. We're getting there. Now, there are some arguments that have been raised by people in order to say, well, yes, the book of Revelation talks about the rapture. The unfortunate thing is, none of these are game-changing arguments that people are unable to raise some objections. I'm going to be looking for a stronger argument. I would say that these are true, but they're not conclusive. Let me point out. In Revelation chapters 4 through 19, we see no mention, not a single mention, of the church on planet Earth. Now, that is consistent with a pre-trib rapture, but guess what happens when you don't have a mention? Some people say, well, it's pre-trib. And some will say, well, there's no mention, I'm going to put it in here. And others say, well, I'll put it in here or here. It's not a conclusive argument from there not being a mention, because people will insert it wherever they want to. We need to have a stronger argument in order to say, why is it that the rapture is before the tribulation? And so we're going to see that. We also have Revelation chapter 4, verse 1. Take a look at that. I do believe that this is a hint at the rapture. But the only people who see it as a hint of the rapture are people who believe in the pre-trib rapture. In other words, it's not one of those verses that you would want to take someone that is opposed to the issue and say, well, look at it here, this verse conclusively proves it. They'll say, doesn't convince me. In chapter 3, it is looking at during the first century on planet Earth. 4:1 says, after these things. It doesn't say how long after, but it's afterwards. I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And that, I believe, is a hint at the rapture. But I have to say, the only people that see it as a hint are people that believe in the pre-trib rapture already. Well, then there's a third passage that people have wanted to go to, and that's Revelation 3:10. Let's take a look at that. And you may remember from last time that I argued for a different punctuation. Remember how in school our teachers told us, don't start a sentence with because. But you look at verse 10 and it starts with because. And it turns out that there are good reasons to say that John didn't start his sentence there either. He started the sentence actually back in verse 8. I'm going to emphasize one word. You're going to hear me emphasize the word I. And I am going to translate the first word in the middle of verse 10 with and instead of saying also. So now let's look at the way that I would see the passage. You can listen to the message from last time, and it will clarify some of the details here. But he says in verse 8, I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, have kept my word, have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you because you have kept the word of my perseverance. And I will also keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Mm-hmm. Now, does this passage say rapture? No, it does not. Was the rapture the way that Jesus kept the first century Philadelphians from entering the tribulation? No. They died. The promise is, I'm not going to let you enter it. I will keep you from it. I will keep you from entering it. But he did not say how he would do it. You know, he even delivered those naughty Corinthians. So technically speaking, this passage is not a rapture passage. But it is reiterating a truth that God will not let anyone that's within the church age, any church age believer, enter the tribulation. but it's technically speaking not a rapture passage. The very last generation of the church on earth, the way that they will be prevented from entering into the tribulation is via the rapture. But lo and behold, so far it looks like we don't have any passage. It's like looking for a clutch in a car with an automatic transmission. Where is it? So we are going to look, and we will find a very strong proof of when the rapture happens within the book of Revelation. But it's not at a place where people normally look. So we are going to consider chapter 5. So, once again, this is a presentation of the views. So let's look at Revelation chapter 5, verse 1. And I saw on the right hand of him, this is the Father, of him who sat on the throne, a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. Now I need to delve a little bit into technology of the first century in order to help depict what's going on. Here we have a scroll that is inscribed in Hebrew. Now you see a lot of writing. Can you tell me anywhere that you do not see writing on this scroll?
On the back.
On the back. You know, when you go and you buy something and a cash register tape comes out, have you ever seen a cash register tape printed on both sides? There's a simple reason that scrolls were normally not inscribed on the back. And that is, okay, this is a statue that's in the Metropolitan Museum in New York that's called the Seated Scribe, and it's from Egypt going back a long, long way. Writing tables, such as we have here, did not come into existence until about the 8th century AD. Scribes wrote in their laps. Now, can you imagine having a scroll and turning it upside down and writing on it in your lap if it's like this? Scrolls were only written on one side. That was one of the major reasons that the Codex came out, because since you are able to utilize both sides of the page, it was a tremendous cost-cutting measure.
John, define Codex.
Oh, this is a Codex. A codex is where you have folded pages that are stitched together with a central binding. I devoted an entire appendix in my dissertation to this because it's pertinent to my dissertation argument. But scribes wrote in their laps. Reading was done in the lap. What we think of as desks and tables were not used for reading and for writing. And so there are only a few passages. Zechariah mentions a two-sided scroll that the technical name is an epistograph. And Revelation 5 mentions one. It's exceedingly rare. Now people have often puzzled over how do these seven seals work? Well, it's not clicking. Very good. This would be one depiction of how it could work. Because the idea, if we look at Revelation chapter 6, is that there's a first seal that's broken. And so then he reads verses 1 through 2. Then he breaks the second seal. And so each of these is progressive through the book. This would be one way that seals could be put to hide the contents of each of those subsequent sections of the book. And so, as we look here now at verse 2 in Revelation 5, it is looking at the question of who is worthy. Then I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals?" And so in verse 3, we're going to have a search that is going to go throughout the universe. Is there anyone qualified to open this? And as they looked in their binoculars, they could find no one that was worthy. So it says in verse 3, and no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look at it. Well, John had a reaction. He wept much. I wept much because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look at it. So he gets reassured by one of the elders that is present. And that's our next slide. Very good. Thank you. But one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and to loose its seven seals." That is, of course, Jesus Christ. No one else was found qualified to open it or to break the seals. So then, our next slide, verse 6, I didn't find a lamb that looked like it had been slain that was standing, so that's the best I could do. And I looked, and behold, in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb as though it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. Obviously, quite a bit of figurative language here, but the concept is Jesus and his message were able to go throughout the world about what Jesus accomplished. And he's the one that's qualified to take this, so therefore, next slide, he took the scroll. He came and he took the scroll out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. So he has taken it now from the Father. This now leads us to the hymn that comes up in the following section of the passage. So once again, next slide. Now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp, a kinnor. If it were using Hebrew, of course this is written in Greek. Lake Kinneret, otherwise known as the Sea of Galilee, is shaped like an Israeli kinnor. And so here on the back side of this coin of the Maccabean era is a depiction of a kinnor. Next slide will show an architectural sized kinnor, and that's so you get kind of an idea of what this musical instrument looks like. Because you notice that it says in verse 8, now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and the golden bowls full of incense, which are or which represent the prayers of the saints. Now we need to ask an important question at this point. And that will be our next slide. The important question is, are the 24 elders that are mentioned here in Revelation 5:8 human, or are they angelic? Are they human beings, or are they angels? We would say that the four living creatures are angelic. But the question, and there's a major controversy over the identity of the 24 elders. So the first question, are they human or are they angelic? Next slide. Now, this may not seem like part of the answer, but notice the statement, sit with me as I sit on my chair. Next slide. Sit with me as I sit on my chair. Does that phrase require that the chair holds more than one person? No, it does not. That's a very important little detail to notice. Next slide. Notice in Revelation 4:4 what it says, if we back up a chapter. Around the throne, and this is the throne of Jesus Christ, around the throne were 24 thrones, and on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting. So these elders are seated, clothed in white robes, and they had crowns of gold on their heads. Now we're going to back up a little further in Revelation to one of the overcomer passages. Next slide. This is Revelation 3:21. I have added some words in brackets, and they're also in yellow, to indicate how I understand this verse. Many people, when they've looked at Revelation 3:21, have thought that the Father had a bench seat, that his throne was a bench seat, and Jesus and the Father both occupy it, and Jesus has a bench seat in which lots of other people, all the overcomers, would sit. But he promises to the overcomer, and an overcomer is a disciple. It is a believer who goes above and beyond, who is rewardable, highly rewardable. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me as I sit on my throne. He's not saying, come join me on my bench seat. But it's as he's depicted here on his throne, around the perimeter are 24 thrones. The overcomer will be on their thrones, but they will be near Christ. Starting to point to the elders as human, not as angels. Because you remember, the book of Hebrews tells us God did not commit rulership to angels. Rulership within the millennial kingdom is going to be restricted to rewardable humans, and of course, Jesus Christ himself. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me as I sit on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father as he sits on his throne. So, next slide. 24 elders are rewardable humans. Now let's take a look a little bit further in the passage. Let's look at 5:10. Jesus, we'll start at verse 9, and I'll be reading from the New King James, so some of you may notice a little different wording at a couple of points. You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe, tongue, people, and nation, and have made them kings and priests to our God, and they shall reign upon the earth. Notice we have the elders being designated as kings. But it's not until chapter 6:1 that the tribulation begins. So it says they shall reign. Their reigning is yet future. Their reigning will happen during the millennium. But they have been designated as kings. How can Jesus Christ designate them as kings? Next slide. The rewards would be received at the Bema. The Bema seat is where believers are evaluated to determine, well done, good and faithful servant, or unacceptable. But still a believer, still possessing everlasting life. So the fact that they were declared to be kings who would reign is a pronouncement that would be made at the Bema. So this passage requires that the Bema has already happened. In fact, if we go back to chapter 4, verse 4, the Bema had to happen before chapter 4, verse 4. Around the throne, Jesus Christ's throne, were 24 thrones, and on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, and so on and so forth. So the Bema has already happened, and it had to happen before chapter 4, verse 4. Well, what event must precede the Bema? Next slide. The rapture. Without the rapture, how are church age believers going to be able to be evaluated at the Bema? So, of necessity, the rapture occurs before the Bema, and the Bema has occurred before chapter 4, verse 4, where they're allowed to sit on their thrones in anticipation of reigning in the future. Well, now the question is, what follows their designation as kings? Next slide. Opening the first seal of the tribulation, chapter 6, verse 1. So, lo and behold, we have a line of evidence, and we are going to pursue it, that will demonstrate that the rapture has to occur prior to the start of the tribulation. That is the only way to make sense of this portion of the text. Next slide. In order to understand this, we are in a section that revolves around a song that is called a new song. And so, if you notice in verse 9, and they sang a new song. This is a song that was composed especially for this occasion. Now, that new song is antiphonal. What I'm going to do is define antiphonal. You can turn to Psalm 136, because we will have an example of another antiphonal song, and you can advance the slide. An antiphonal song is one in which you have a singing and a response. And so you have different groups of singers that are singing different portions of the song. When it says they sang, it doesn't mean that every being that's involved sang every single word of this new song. So in Psalm 136, there's a call. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. And the response, sung by a different group. For his mercy, his chesed, endures forever. Then there's another call. Oh, give thanks to the God of gods. And the response, for his mercy endures forever. And it goes back and forth through the entirety of the song. In the same way, we are going to see here in this new song, we have a choir that starts out small and it grows huge, and then the number of singers once again comes down. Next slide. We have an antiphonal arrangement. I've depicted a choir arrangement. You'll have your sopranos, your bass, you'll have your altos and your tenors. You're going to have them in different places, and they're going to sing at different times, and they're going to have different words to sing. Well, the 24 elders sing verse 9. Verse 10 is sung by the four living creatures. We'll see evidence for these designations. Then in verses 11 and 12, we have many angels plus the living creatures plus the elders. Then in verse 13, we have all of creation. I mean, this just becomes the biggest choir you could imagine. But then it shrinks back down. In 5:14a, it's just the four living creatures. And in 5:14b, it says that the 24 elders worshipped. Now the question is, did they worship with their lips zipped? Or does it mean when it says that they worshipped that they continued singing a part of the new song? I would argue that since this is within the context of the new song, they had words to sing that haven't been recorded for us. So you notice how I've arranged this as a chiasm, that have 24 singing, then we have 4 singing, they're joined by many angels, then all of creation sings, and then the four living creatures, and then back down to the 24 elders.
John, very quickly, chiasm, why it's called.
These two parts relate to each other. These two relate, and these two. The letter chi, or as we mispronounce it, chi, is a letter that looks like an X, but it is the letter CH as in Christ. And so that shape is the way that they describe this type of a pattern, where it starts out and returns to the same basic group once all over again. And so here in this, we have all these singers. Now the issue that we're going to look at is evidence that it was the 24 elders that sang verse 9. We are also going to be looking for evidence within verse 9 that they are human. Now, unfortunately, we have a little handicap. I think most everyone here is probably looking at a New American Standard Bible, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't have a word in there that I believe should be in there, and I'm going to make a short case for that word belonging in your text. It's the word us. So, next slide. You didn't know you were going to get to look at Greek manuscripts. Well, most manuscripts, including manuscript Sinaiticus, include the word us, and there it is, with boxes around it. And so it would here read, you were slain and redeemed, literally, redeemed to God us, that is, redeemed us to God by your blood from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. Tribe, tongue, people, and nation is a standard designation that often appears in the Old Testament. It equals Gentiles. So, from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation is another way of saying from among the Gentiles. But that word us is in that text, and it's in most every manuscript. There is only one manuscript that just leaves it out. Let's look at the next slide. That is the favorite manuscript of Kurt Aland. And Kurt Aland is the man whose texts most English translations follow. And his favorite manuscript left that word us out. But it's very interesting where it left it out. Here we are at the bottom of a column, and he should have put the word us in as the very last word. And doesn't it look like he dipped his pen in ink? Mm-hmm. You know, he took a coffee break there. And he came back and he started writing at the top of the next column. He left the word us out and the sentence still made sense. He didn't catch that he left the word us out. And it's the only manuscript that does it. But it's Kurt Aland's favorite manuscript. And the English translations, modern English translations, Kurt Aland's text is their favorite text to use. As a result, the word us got left out in most translations.
In the New American Standard, where
is us? You have some words in italics. I'm sorry, I don't have a New American.
Man.
The blood man.
Okay. That instead of men, it would be us.
Okay.
So now here's the important thing about saying us. Can an angel say, you have redeemed us?
No.
No. Because Jesus didn't go to the cross to pay for the sins of angels. He didn't redeem angels. He redeemed human beings that believe him for his gift of everlasting life. The people that are speaking this or singing this are human. You are worthy because you were slain and have redeemed us from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. So that's why I argue. Verse 10 is sung by humans, the 24 elders. This is a song that was composed for the occasion. The arrangement has been done by the Lord himself. He's not going to have, in a new song, angels singing words that are only applicable to humans. So verse 9 is sung by 24 elders that are highly rewardable church-age believers. And they say, you are worthy to take the scroll, you are worthy to break each of its seven seals, and your worthiness is established by the fact that you went to the cross, paid for all the sins of the world, and you have bought us, who are of every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. Mm-hmm. You redeemed even us Gentiles.
John, if I could just point out, and this confirms what you're saying, if you've got the New American Standard, notice men is in what?
Italics.
That means it was supplied by the translators. They're trying to clear up what John was referring to. They're saying it wasn't in their manuscript, but they're saying it should be.
If you cross out those words that are in italics, the verse is going to be a little hard to read. They sense the need to add something. And this particular manuscript, it's the only one that did it, and let's take a closer look at that. I'll let you look at a little more Greek. Next slide. This is the bottom line of the one column, and this is the top line of the other. Mm-hmm. And it definitely looks like he dipped his pen. He took a coffee break. And his mind went wandering, and he left out that word. Next slide. Nestle Aland, that's the text that I was mentioning, or the UBS, also published by him. The Westcott Fort text and Tischendorf's text, they all chose to omit the word us because they liked this manuscript. Mm-hmm. They said, this manuscript, whatever it does, will follow. But the majority text, von Soden, Vogels, Bover, Merck, and some others, all include the word us because it's everywhere. All the manuscripts have it. But most English translations follow this text. And that's the reason that us is not there in your text. So now let's look, next slide, at the majority text for verses 9 and 10. And they sang a new song saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us, that is the elders and others, to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation. Verse 10 now is sung by the four living creatures. And so in your text, everything reads correctly except instead of saying kings, it will say a kingdom. What it should read here in verse 10, and you have made them, and this is sung by the four living creatures, you have made them, you have made the elders, these 24 elders, kings and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth. They aren't reigning right now because the tribulation hasn't even started, let alone ended. But the Bema seat has occurred. They have been designated kings, and they will reign. This is being sung about humans that would be kings. It could not be sung about angels, because angels will not reign. Humans, believers in Jesus Christ that are highly rewardable, are the ones that will be kings. Next slide. So we have a sequence of events here between Revelation 4:1 and chapter 20. verse 1. The pre-trib rapture, where he saw an opened door in heaven, is looking at the rapture. Four verses later, chapter 4, verse 4, it mentions those that are elders that were sitting on those 24 thrones that will reign. So the Bema, where these people have been designated kings, has to have happened somewhere between chapter 4, verse 1 and 4, verse 4. Then, in chapter 6, 1, we have the first seal judgment. Now, you remember I promised way back when that I said that we would discuss that the entire 7 years is divine wrath. Take a look. Look at Revelation 6, 1. Now, I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, with a voice like thunder, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. This is not a good guy on this horse. This is judgment coming out. But those that don't believe in a pre-trib rapture say, well, this is just human wrath. It isn't God's wrath. Wait a moment. Who broke open the seal? Who enabled it to happen? Whose action unleashed this upon planet Earth?
Jesus.
How can this not be an expression of divine wrath, divine judgment? The entirety of the 7 years is characterized by wrath that happens because Jesus opens seals. He opens trumpets and he opens bowls. It's at his inception. So wrath characterizes the entirety of the 7 years. But then we get to chapter 20, verse 6, and that's where we see highly rewardable saints beginning to reign with Jesus. So lo and behold, chapter 5 is not a place where many people expect to find in the book of Revelation when the rapture occurs. Mm-hmm. And they look at it and they essentially say, where's the clutch? They're like my friend Dale when he saw that car and it was the first one with an automatic transmission he had ever seen in his life. And it's, how am I going to shift gears without grinding? Well, the book of Revelation did not forget to mention issues that tell us when the rapture occurs. Next slide. Verse 10 again is looking at a depiction. We've got, you have made them kings and priests to our God. We've got the 24 elders, each sitting on their thrones around Jesus Christ on his throne. Remember our understanding of chapter 3:21 isn't that Jesus has a bench seat, but sitting with him means sitting near him as he sits on his throne, but each of those 24 elders who will be kings and priests to our God, each has their own throne. The idea is Jesus will be like an emperor over planet Earth. And under him will be kings. And those kings will reign over nations, individual nations. But he's going to rule over all of them. That's why he can be called King over kings and Lord over lords. He will have kings and he will have lords that will be his subjects. But those who will be kings, those who will be lords, those who will be governors are highly rewarded, overcoming believers. That's why when Dix is talking about the importance of discipleship, it's huge.
Amen.
Everlasting life is a free gift. to anyone who simply believes Jesus Christ for his promise of everlasting life. The 24 that are around here all received that gift. But they didn't just wander through life. They lived their lives seeking to be pleasing to God, learning his word, using his word, ministering with his word, being rewardable disciples. Next slide. So again, we have a sequence. Pre-trib rapture at 4:1. The Bema before 4:4. First seal, starting the tribulation, 6:1. And it is when we get to chapter 20 that highly rewardable believers start to reign with Jesus. Next slide. So, instead of these being looked at as non-game-changing, they are supplemental arguments. We can see that the non-mention of the church on planet Earth between chapters 4 and 19 fits entirely well with a pre-trib rapture. Chapter 4, verse 1 is the place where we would see the rapture, because it had to be before 4:4. And that's an apt description, seeing an open door through which the church goes up into heaven. And then, although Revelation 3:10 is not a rapture passage, it is consistent with the rapture. It looked at people being delivered by physical death, because the guarantee is no church age believer will enter the tribulation, because the church is not destined for wrath. 1 Thessalonians 5. Final slide. So yes, Revelation does pin down the rapture, so Eeyore can have his tail. Thank you.
Questions?
So who are those four creatures?
They're a high level of angelic being. I think that there are a few other passages where they come up, but in Ezekiel and that, but I don't have a lot of details on them, because there isn't really a great deal written about them in the text.
But they're angels.
They're angelic beings.
Angelic beings, some sort.
Yes. I still don't understand the significance of the writing on both sides of the scroll.
Oh, it is a highly unusual scroll. He's saying, this isn't just your garden variety. This is a special one. Because it was very hard to end up writing on both sides. They use papyrus, and if you roll papyrus backwards, it breaks. And so it's being pointed out as a very significant scroll, that it was worth going to that degree of effort.
Plus the fact those scrolls would have seals. It mentioned seals in there, and it says who's worthy. And the problem is there's only, and it's not just, you know, anybody can break a seal. But a seal worthy is, you have to have the authority to break the seal. For instance, if I send you a letter back then, I'd seal it with my stamp on it, and if it's to you, only I or you are the ones that could open it. So it's even further indication of the deity of Christ.
Like certified now.
Yeah. By the way, I would say that there are either saints that are rapture delivered or rip delivered. Rest in peace.
Yep.
Rapture or rip. Other questions? Comments?
Other than Mary McNamara, do you think there's any possibility that 24 elders will be coming from Crosspoint?
That could happen. That could happen.
It's a goal.
Absolutely.
Shoot high, aim high.
I will tell you that, you know, this is somewhat the way that I've sometimes described it is, you know, an army. You've got a bunch of privates, and you've got very few generals. And the generals are the ones who've excelled, and they've got that high position. Now, not everyone can be a general, but there's nothing wrong with being a colonel, a lieutenant colonel, a captain, or a major. And so all of us,
We may not make the top 24, but I tell you what, keep reaching. You never know when you might be reporting to one of those elders.
Do the rewards have anything to do with that?
Yes, because that is based on how well you've been a disciple and how well you've been faithful to Christ. You are rewarded, and I think that places you. You start moving up the ranks, so to speak.
This is the highest.
Yeah.
This is the highest.
These are five-star generals.
This is the highest king, nation-related reward. I believe that some of the apostles got an even higher level of reward, which is empire-related. It seems to me that John, Paul, and some of the others... descriptions that are given there, they're not limited to having influence within a particular government, but within Jesus' administration over the whole earth.